So when I started my PhD 4 or so years ago, the initial project that we were working on was trying to understand landslide recurrence intervals in the Appalachian Mountains in North Carolina. This involved us digging a lot of soil pits in these areas of topographic convergence. So you can maybe see if you squint, if you look along this tree line here, there's a small kind of bowl-shaped depression in the landscape. So these are important for landslide hazard because these focus rainwater and material into the centre of the hollows where we dig these pits. And then this is the point at which landslides will be initiated from. So we're interested in what happens is after we have a landslide and we scour down to bedrock, how long does it take for soil to build back up on that bare surface so that another landslide can take place? So we spend a lot of time digging holes, taking soil samples and thinking about a lot of this. But one of the challenges that we identified was that we didn't really understand the geometry of the surrounding hill slopes. So we didn't really have any measure of the transport distances flowing into the apex from the side slopes and from the ridge lines. So this led to an ill-fated conversation with Simon, which we realised that we needed to understand the geometry of hill slopes better. And Simon at the time described this as low-hanging fruit that would take maybe 6 months, maybe a year, just a little sidetrack on my PhD before going back to working on landslides. And as you'll see from the remainder of this talk, it took me 4 years, and I encompassed the whole of my PhD. So the question basically became how we could measure hill slope length. And if you think about that glibly, or you dig around in the literature, there's a lot of different ways that you could go about making these kind of measurements. So obviously the first thing you could do is you could take a tape measure, or you could take a ruler on a paper map, or even a ruler tool on a GIS package, and just straight line measure hill slopes. That's one option. Another option would be to measure slope area plots, or to analyse an inversion of drainage density, or to perform some method of flow routing across landscapes. And for the rest of this talk, I'm going to be mentioning 4 different landscapes. All my work is done at a very broad landscape scale, so I'm not going to get into too much fine detail about different landscape properties. But just to give you guys an idea of where I'm talking about, what the landscapes look like when I mention them, the first of my landscapes is the Arden Coast Range, which is generally characterised as being a very well-behaved landscape. It's got regular drainages, it's in approximate topographic steady state, so uplift and erosion is basically in balance. So a lot of people use this landscape as a good natural laboratory for geomorphic research. The other landscape that we worked in is at Kawita in North Carolina, so this is where I was digging all these soil pits. And then Gabilan Mesa is another one of these kind of classic geomorphic landscapes, which is a very regular landscape and has the benefit of having very little vegetation cover. It's mainly chaparral and scrubland. So you can process it to a bare earthy really easily and get a really nice topographic signal. And the final landscape is a landscape that a lot of people in this department have done a lot of work on, so in the Northern Sierra in California. And I'm not going to say too much about this landscape, but Dave Mildowski is down the front, and he's the man to ask. So I'll just put you on the spot, Dave. So those are the landscapes that I'm working on. So going back to our question about how we can measure hill slope length, and this first option that we came up with was this idea of using a ruler. So in 1996, Niels Hovius did just that for a series of mountain fronts across the world. This is the Himalaya. And the technique that he employed was simply to manually identify the trunk streams draining each valley and mark them with one of these little triangles. He then took a ruler on a 1 to 100,000 scale topographic map and measured the distance between these triangles. If you have that distance, you get an approximation of the length of a hill slope in that valley. So it's a simplistic method, but the problems are that it's very time consuming. If you imagine doing this 10 times or even 1,000 times, it's going to be really painstaking. And it's going to be very subjective to make measurements like this. If you give 2 different people the task of doing the same measurements, you'll get different values. One of the other challenges that's not such an issue for working at this kind of broad mountain front scale, but is an issue when we start to think about individual landslide source areas, is that there's no consideration of local topography. So if we're just putting a ruler and a straight edge across a map, we're not taking into account any local lumps and bumps on the land surface. So this is a technique that doesn't really fit any of our requirements for measuring hill slope length. So we just throw this technique out and we're not going to think any further about it. The next technique that we use is the analysis of slope area plots. So to construct a slope area plot, you take a DEM of a drainage basin and then sample the local slope for every pixel in that DEM and the upslope drainage area for every pixel in that DEM. And then you can plot these in log-log space with drainage area on X and the slope on Y. Theory dictates that if you have a drainage basin and you do this, you should see some sort of shape like this. It's often described as a boomerang. the way to visualize how this actually represents a landscape is if we start at this left-hand edge of the boomerang, that's equivalent to us standing on a ridgeline. So we have a low gradient point in the landscape with a very low drainage area because there's no land directly above us. As we step down off the ridgeline and then travel up this rising limb, that's us walking down off the ridgeline down the hill slope. So the gradient's increasing and the drainage area is increasing because, again, we're having more land behind us. We then reach this rollover point at which we start to see some initiation of fluvial processes. And then from this point down this falling limb of the boomerang, this is effectively a river-long profile. So if we think back to high school geography, the upper course of a river is high gradient and low drainage area, and the lower course is low gradient and high drainage area. And that's what we see in this plot. So the important thing for our purposes in interpreting these plots is this inflection point, this kink in the boomerang. And from this, we can identify the characteristic drainage area for each drainage basin. That gives us an idea of the support area needed to initiate fluvial processes. And usually what people then do is that they divide that area through by the grid resolution of the data they're working with in order to convert that into a characteristic length, making all sorts of assumptions that I'll go into in a wee while, and then use that in order to estimate hill slope length for that drainage basin. So that's the theory. If we actually look at some real data, the story's not nearly as simple. So this is some data from Kawita, from the place where we're digging all the soil pits. And if you look at it, I mean, maybe you can convince yourself there's some sort of rising limb here, but then you've just got this massive data cloud, and really there's no pattern there. What people usually do to try and get around this is that they'll log bin the data, smooth the data, do some sort of spatial averaging to the data, and then try and fit a curve through that average data. So if we do that, following kind of standard techniques, you get a spline curve that looks something like this. And you might be able to convince yourself that there's kind of a rising limb here, and there's some sort of inflection point, and then it drops off. But it's not as convincing as our idealized model. If we do this again, we get even more weird data. I mean, this might be a bit more boomerang shape, but it's got very kind of diffuse, rounded kinks, so it's going to be very challenging to identify that transition point. Another example, some more data, and this one is just doesn't conform to our model at all. It's completely ridiculous. And then finally, if we have a look at this, I think this is more characteristic of the pound falling Brexit than it is any kind of data. I don't know, should I have updated that joke for the US dollar after? Anyway.
Don't worry, I'll get right again.
So if we apply this technique for every drainage basin in our four test landscapes, we can build up some histograms of the distribution of hill slope length that we're getting out of this admittedly noisy data. So these histograms, I've shown a few of these, the black bars are bars within one median absolute deviation of the median value, which is the red dashed line, and then the grey bars are outliers. So if we focus first on the Oregon Coast Range data, this is this landscape that's considered to be very regular, very well-behaved, a really good test landscape. We get a median value of 6 metres with an absolute deviation of 1 metre. And if we go and just look at the landscape, or go examine the landscape, the hill slopes are a lot longer than 6 metres on average. It's just it's a completely unbelievable value based on the reality on the ground. So we have similar problems in Kawita with a median value of 28 metres with an absolute deviation of 14 metres. I spent a lot of time in the field in Kawita, and I wish the hill slopes were only 28 metres long, I'll tell you that. And even in other landscapes where we do have kind of more plausible lengths, we have very large deviations, particularly in Sierra Nevada, where we have a median of 177, but an absolute deviation of 173. So there's a lot of noise in this data. So there's a lot of challenges in using this technique. One of the biggest ones is actually just picking out that inflection point in the smooth data. As you saw in some of the example curves, sometimes there is no inflection point, sometimes the inflection point is very diffuse, so you could place it anywhere within a kind of 100 metre hill slope length range. And even doing it computationally, as we've done for these hundreds of basins in the four landscapes, it's very difficult to be confident in the values that you're getting out. As I've mentioned, there's also the challenges of binning and smoothing the data, so people do this in different ways, so you can spatially average the data or numerically average it or do some sort of log binning process. There's a lot of ways of massaging the data to try and pull out the trend that you want to see. One of the biggest challenges that I mentioned briefly in the past is this idea of dividing this characteristic area by the grid resolution. And this is a holdover from when people performed this kind of analysis using not gridded digital elevation models, but digital contour models. So in the past, instead of using a grid resolution measurement, people would use the unit contour width, which is generally a value that is set based on hydrological properties, so it has some actual fundamental meaning related to the landscape. over time in the literature, this value's just been conflated with grid resolution, and it's now got to the point where people just automatically assume that we can use grid resolution, even though it has no hydrological significance to the rest of our measurements. So just this single step really does call into question a lot of the reliability of these results. So the next technique that we can evaluate is the use of drainage density. So very simply, we can calculate drainage density for a basin by measuring the total length of channels and dividing it by the basin area. That gives us the drainage density for a basin, and we can repeat this measurement across our landscape at a range of spatial scales. And there's been a lot of work by people like Strahler and Horton, and more recently by Greg Tucker, demonstrating that we can approximate household length by inverting drainage density. So the idea is that drainage density is giving us some understanding of the channels, so if we invert that measurement, we're getting some understanding of the households. And again, if we use the same drainage basins as we had before with our slope area measurements, we can see that in each case, we're getting very low median values. So although we're getting maybe a more believable distribution, particularly in the Oregon Coast Range, which is conforming more to our expectations of how the landscape looks qualitatively, but in each case, our median value and the majority of our values are falling way below what we would expect qualitatively from looking at the landscape. So this suggests that this isn't a great technique to use because of the lack of spatial variability. So calculating drainage density doesn't give us much spatial variation and granularity in our household length measurements. And it's also a method that's very sensitive to the accuracy of how we extract channel networks. So a lot of people in this room will be really familiar with tools like ArcMap or QGIS, and we'll use the hydrology toolboxes to extract channel networks. These generally operate defining an area threshold with which you can extract a channel network. So if you're defining an area threshold to extract your channel network, then you're automatically going to be setting some sort of limits and controls on what the drainage density can be in that landscape. So we have to go beyond that and use a method that identifies channel heads using some sort of process transition identification. But even when we do that, we still don't see the same variation in household length that we would expect to see from our observations in the field. One of the other challenges is the drainage density, or certainly the way that we apply drainage density, doesn't account for the width of channels. So in landscapes that are very broad channels and very broad floodplains, they're still approximated in most GIS packages as a single pixel. And in our case, we're working with high-resolution data, so working on 1 meter pixels. So we have a very small representation of a channel. And then when we invert that value, we're going to overestimate the household length as a result. So this moves us on to our last technique that we can use, and that's this idea of flow routing. So the idea simply is that we can actually just measure household length directly from DEMs as a flow path. So in this example from the Oregon Coast Range, the red lines are flow paths, and the blue is obviously a channel. And the idea is that we can connect ridgelines to channels by following a trace running from the ridgeline down to the channel, and then measure the length, the transport distance of this length, to give us a measure of household length. So something to be familiar with using steepest descent algorithms. For those of you that aren't, and if we have our example DEM here, we've got 9 cells, each of these values is an elevation value. And if we start our flow in the top left cell, and then the steepest descent algorithm is going to search all the neighbors, so we'll have to just accept that we don't have any values right here, but we're looking for the lowest elevation neighbor to 480. So in this case, that's the value 430. So the flow is then partitioned into that cell. And then again, we perform the search around the 8 neighbors and find that 400 is the lowest elevation value and partition flow there. And we repeat this process across whole landscapes, and this allows us to partition flow from ridgelines into channels. The problem with using this steepest descent technique, as you can maybe see, is that you get these very straight line paths. If we imagine scaling this up across a whole landscape rather than just a 9-cell neighborhood, we'd wind up with very straight flow lines with kind of 45-degree junctions or 90-degree junctions. And again, if we think about how water and material moves across surfaces, it very rarely flows in perfectly straight lines, taking right-angle corners or 45-degree corners. So to overcome this limitation, we use a different technique, which follows pixel aspect rather than pixel elevation. So we have the same DEM grid here, but now we have aspect values, which are the direction each cell is facing in degrees clockwise from north. And if we start in the top left-hand corner and start partitioning flow, we follow flow at an angle of 100 degrees until we reach a cell boundary, at which point we sample the aspect in the next cell and follow the flow path at 150 degrees. and then south at 170, 120, and 90. And this, with the same data, gives us a much smoother flow path flowing within the pixels rather than the straight line path that we had previously. And we can then scale that up across whole landscape. So this is an example from the Gabbro Mesa, where we can run traces down from the ridge lines down into the channels or into the floodplain. And just to note, this is about 1% of all the traces that we actually sample from the landscape. If we were to plot every single trace we take from a landscape, we'd just see a red map because of the density of measurements that we're taking. This is quite a nice illustration of the way that the flow paths are following topography and tracing down into the channel networks. So again, using the same input data, we've now measured hill slope length. Instead of on a per basin basis, we're now on an individual hill slope pixel basis. And as you can see, we're now getting tens and 50,000 measurements in a lot of cases for each of our landscapes. So we've really increased the density of measurement and the spatial distribution of our measurements when compared to the basin average measures that we used with the slope area and the drainage density techniques. And the reassuring thing when we think of just our qualitative observations of the landscapes is that we start to see believable values of in excess of 100 metres in each case. Kaulitz has very long hill slopes, median of 228. And in the Oregon Coast Range, which is this well-behaved landscape that we expect to be fairly regular with uniform drainage areas, uniform ridge valley spacings, and we see this nice, almost normal distribution of measurements. So this is quite reassuring that this technique is actually getting at some sort of fundamental measurement of the landscape. And one of the other benefits of this is that it does account for local topography. So if you remember back when I was talking about using a ruler or a straight edge to measure hill slope length, and we had this problem that at hill slope scales we were dampening out local topographic variations. And this technique is specifically designed to account for these local topographic variations. So if you have a tree throw mound or a pit, the material flow will be deflected across or into these various obstacles. Another benefit is because this is all software-based, it's a completely subjective method. So once you feed it a DEM and press run, there's nothing you can do to mess with the results. So unlike the slope area plotting where you could smooth or fudge the data somehow or eyeball how you're going to pick out your inflection point, the results you get are the results you get. This is just a simple illustration of the three techniques for the four landscapes. So we have the landscape average slope area value for Kaulitz, the Oregon Coast Range, Gabbro Mesa, and Sierra Nevada. With the blue points, the black points are the hilltop flow routing data, and the red are the drainage density data. Then this brings into focus just how unreliable the slope area measurements are. We see the scale of the error bars. So these error bars are one median absolute deviation. So we have very tight error bars for the drainage density method in three of the landscapes, again suggesting this lack of variability. But the question at the top of the slide, I think, is valid. And you've all sat through this and said, OK, so we've got the best method for measuring hill slope length is the flow routing method. Hopefully I've convinced you at least some of the way towards that, but why do we care? And part of the reason that we care about this is that the flow routing technique, it gives us access to a lot of other data from topography. The most important of this is the hilltop relief. So when we're measuring our traces running from the ridge line in red down into the channel in blue, we can sample the elevation at the channel and at the ridge and difference them to get the local relief across the hill slope at that point. Similarly, we can sample the curvature along the ridge line to get a measure of the hilltop curvature. And that's a parameter that we'll talk about a bit later in the talk. But with these three data values spread at very high density across our landscape, we can now actually test sediment flux laws. Expected a bit more of a ooh there. So sediment flux is a measurement of the volume of sediment transported on a hill slope per unit area in a period of time. So effectively, it's some sort of measure of the efficiency of sediment transport on hill slopes. And the reason that we care about it is that it fundamentally sets the geometry of a hill slope. So we don't see, without some sort of understanding of the sediment flux for landscapes like this in Southern California, we don't understand why we get this kind of rounded geometry on the hilltops. It's also vital in setting the landscape response to both climatic and tectonic forcing. So if we want to understand what's happening in a changing world with a changing climate, we need to understand sediment flux. And finally, it's an important parameter in landscape evolution modeling. So again, if we want to have some sort of understanding of landscapes through numerical models, we do need some kind of grasp of what kind of sediment flux law to actually apply in our models. So I'm going to talk about two kind of N-member sediment flux laws. If you go and dig into the literature, there's a lot of different laws out there. We're going to stick with two of the kind of most broadly accepted and the simplest models. The first of these is a linear model of sediment flux, denoted by the dotted line. And this simply states that the rate of sediment flux increases linearly in proportion to slope. The other N-member of this is a non-linear model, which although is similar at very low gradients, as we increase slope and we tend towards this threshold gradient here, we start to see the rate of sediment flux asymptote towards infinity. So we get this runaway increase in sediment flux with topographic gradient. And there are a lot of other models, as I say, that incorporate things like individual particle motion or sediment thickness alongside slope gradient. But generally speaking, we can't evaluate a lot of these models because we don't have the field data yet to go with them. So all we're going to do for the next section of this talk is discuss these two N-member models and try and understand which one of these best captures what's happening on our landscapes. So in 1993, Keane and others made one of the first attempts to try and constrain and demonstrate that linear flux was taking place on landscapes. So they took a transect along a hill slope and measured sediment flux using cosmogenic radionuclides and then plotted their two data points plus the origin against slope. So unsurprisingly, they did demonstrate a linear relationship, but it's maybe not the most convincing trend that you'll see. Luckily, in 1999, Small and others repeated the experiment across two further hill slopes with a lot more data points and did indeed show that the data is broadly linear. So maybe they were onto something and they just ran out of money for more samples. Around the same time in 1999, Josh Roaring was also using similar measurements of cosmogenic radionuclides coupled with basin topographic measurements to demonstrate a non-linearity in sediment flux with topographic gradient. So these two, the solid line and the dashed line, are his model bounds. So he's demonstrating that the vast majority of his topographic measurements are plotting within his model parameters. Incidentally, this misfit of the model here is due to the grid resolution effects of his model. So if you had an infinitely fine DEM, then you would see the solution converge a lot better. This is a really great piece of evidence that we're seeing non-linearity in this relationship between gradient and sediment flux. In 2001, he performed some more experiments, this time an analog experiments with an inclined sandbox and a speaker to acoustically disturb sediment, and again demonstrated a strong non-linearity in sediment flux with topographic gradient. So I've talked about linear and non-linear flux, and you're probably all fed up with hearing about it, but if we can think about the what this actually means for what landscapes look like, hopefully it will bring into focus why we're interested in this. So if we imagine a simple one-dimensional hill slope here with a ridgeline 50 metres and 50 metres either side, it's being uplifted at 0.1 millimetres per year and is evolving under a linear sediment flux. If we increase the uplift rate to 0.2 millimetres per year, we see that we get this really big buildup of relief. And again, if we increase to 0.3 millimetres per year, we've now got this really large buildup of relief without a corresponding increase in hill slope length. So we're seeing a much steeper landscape when we're experiencing linear sediment flux. And then the opposite case of this, when we're using the nonlinear model, so everything else is held the same, the only thing that's changing is we're now using nonlinear sediment flux instead of linear sediment flux, and we start to uplift our hill slope, you see that we have much less buildup of relief in proportion to the increase in hill slope length, so we have a lower gradient landscape. So that's the two kind of characteristic topographic signatures that we can start to look for in our landscapes. And the best way of demonstrating this is to think about the relationship between relief and hill slope length. So for our linear model of sediment flux, the first set of 1D hill slopes that I showed, we get this runaway buildup of relief as hill slope length gradually increases. Whereas if we look at the nonlinear model of sediment flux, denoted by the dashed line, we have this much more quasi-linear relationship between relief and hill slope length. So we have a fundamental difference in what our landscapes will look like if they're experiencing linear or nonlinear sediment flux. And so we can test that. You know, we in the first part of this talk, I showed you that we can measure hill slope length and we can get relief out. So if we plot relief and hill slope length for Kawita, our first landscape, there's maybe a linear trend there, maybe. It's not great, there's not that much data. Similarly, if you look at Gabilan Mesa, there's more data, and it's a broadly linear trend. But again, it's not massively convincing. But when we start to look at the Oregon Coast Range, this much more well-behaved landscape, we get this much more linear relationship. So this suggests that we're seeing relief in household length in the proportions that we would expect if we were seeing nonlinear sedimentary flux. So if we had a broadly a landscape undergoing broadly linear flux, we'd expect to see the relief building up much more quickly here as we saw in the schematic. And similarly, if we look in the Sierra Nevada, there's a lot more scatter in this landscape. But again, there's this broadly linear trend extending out to 300 or 400 meters of household length. So from that, we can say that topography is consistent with nonlinear sediment flux. This is a really cool result because it's the first time this has been demonstrated at a landscape scale. So in the past, when people have done these kind of tests, they focus on an individual hill slope or an individual drainage basin and managed to demonstrate that this hill slope or this basin follows the model. Whereas in this case, we've taken four distinct landscapes across the continental United States, experiencing different vegetation, climate, and erosional patterns, and we're still able to pick out this fairly strong signature. This test also only relies on topographic data. So the previous tests that people have employed have used cosmogenics or numerical modeling or analog modeling or some combination of all of these things to try and test flux loss. Whereas all this needs is high resolution topographic data. And again, kind of building on that, we can apply this anywhere. The software is built and can be run on anywhere that we have this high res data. So in theory, we can keep testing this and build up much more evidence for nonlinear sediment flux. And if you'd like to learn a little bit more, I'm just going to do some shameless plugging. The research I've just showed came out in my first paper in ESPL earlier this year. Everyone should at least download it just to push the metrics up a little bit. You don't have to read it. Definitely download it. So once we submitted this paper, the question I was asking myself was, what else can we do with this data? So we have these measurements of hillslope length and relief that no one's ever had before. People have had kind of one or two measurements or small amounts of measurements or haven't really exploited them to their full potential. And the answer to that question came from another Josh Roaring's papers in 2007, where he wrote about functional relationships between denudation, hillslope form, and relief. And in this paper, one of the kind of the key results and the key figure is this figure here, where he non-dimensionalized measurements of curvature, E star, and relief R star within the nonlinear sediment flux model. So the thing to understand about this plot is that if we have a landscape that's experiencing nonlinear sediment flux, as we think most of our landscapes are, and the landscape is in topographic steady state, as two of our landscapes have been demonstrated by other authors, then the measurement of E star and R star for that landscape should plot somewhere on this black steady state curve. To give you an idea of what I mean when I say dimensionless curvature and dimensionless relief, we can look at two of our example landscapes, the Oregon Coast Range and Gavilan Mesa. If we think about E star, this dimensionless curvature value, a high E star value, so to the right of the x-axis, corresponds to a landscape with very sharp, steep ridges, so like the Oregon Coast Range. Conversely, a landscape like Gavilan Mesa with much more rounded hilltops has a much lower E star value. Similarly, a high R star value corresponds to a landscape with high topographic relief, again, like the Oregon Coast Range. And Gavilan Mesa has a much lower R star value with its much lower topographic relief. So we can calculate E star as negative 2 multiplied by the hilltop curvature multiplied by the hillslope length divided by the critical gradient from the nonlinear flux law. And we can calculate R star as relief divided by the critical gradient multiplied by the hillslope length. So when Josh Roaring presented this theory, he tested it using two data points for each landscape. So the blue points are Gavilan Mesa, and the red points are the Oregon Coast Range. So he took some idealized basins from each of these data sets, measured these parameters of hillslope curvature, hillslope length, and relief, estimated the critical gradient, and demonstrated that these two steady state landscapes do indeed plot somewhere near the steady state curve. And that's a really interesting result, but no one had really taken it any further than that. And that led to the question, can we do this with more than two data points? Now that we can measure hillslope length and relief and hilltop curvature at really high density across our landscapes automatically, can we build on this? And the answer, of course, is yes, because the three parameters that we need, we have. And we have them just sitting there in data files that we can easily process. So this allows us to perform an additional test of nonlinear sediment flux. Simply put, if we are unable to replicate Josh Roaring's results, that could suggest that the nonlinear model is insufficient at describing the sediment transport relationships in the landscape. It's also going to allow us to identify tectonic characteristics of the landscapes, because we have this idea that a landscape that's undergoing it's in the topographic steady state, so uplift is balanced with erosion, will plot on the steady state curve. It'll also give us an ability to understand the variability of landscape properties. So going to Gabo and Mesa, and I've written some software that calculates E star and R star using all the data that we've previously looked at, and if you plot the data, you get a data cloud. So this is a density plot, so it's not quite as bad as it initially looks. So the redder areas are where we've got lots of points, thousands of points stacked one on top of the other. So what this actually means is that although there is this scatter, it's actually a vanishingly small percentage of all the measurements we have in our data set. And if we place a landscape average data point on that with a 1 median absolute deviation error bar, we actually see that around 85 to 95% of all the hill slope pixels that we've measured in our landscape are plotting within that range, so sitting very close to the steady state curve. So this gives us a lot of confidence that we are seeing a landscape in Gabo and Mesa that is in approximate topographic steady state. We can repeat the same experiment for the Oregon Coast Range, another of these landscapes that's in approximate topographic steady state. And again, there's this large amount of noise when you first look at the data. When you put this average data point on with the error bars, you see again, we're seeing something like 85 to 95% of all the data is actually plotting very close to the steady state curve. So this gives us a lot of confidence in Josh Roaring's conclusions and gives us a little bit more evidence for nonlinear sediment flux. So we can also think about trying to detect uplift and decay in our landscapes. So if we have a landscape that's not in topographic steady state, Martin Hurst in his 2013 science paper demonstrated that we would see E-star, R-star data plotting above the steady state curve for a landscape that's actively uplifting. And for a landscape that's decaying, so in that case it's got erosion outcompeting uplift, it's plot below the steady state curve. So this lets me ask a really kind of high-handed philosophical question as we kind of begin to wrap this talk up. And that's, why do the Appalachian Mountains exist? Or more importantly, why are they so big? Why is there still so much relief? So if you go to the Appalachians and look around, you'll see there's lots of waterfalls. There's lots of landsliding, and that's why I'm here in the first place. Originally, I was supposed to be looking at landsliding. And there's a lot of relief preserved across the range. So this landscape looks like a landscape that's been very recently uplifted, that's experiencing tectonic uplift. But most of the evidence suggests that uplift ceased around 200 million years ago. So we have a problem and a disconnect in our understanding of the geology and how this range has evolved through the last few hundred million years and the actual topographic observations that we can make. And I'd just like to caveat this by saying that I was really bad at geology in my undergrads. This is a bit of a gross simplification. But there's two broad theories about why we still have so much relief in the Appalachian Mountains and why there's still why the mountains still exist. Everyone okay?
Didn't call it anyone.
Okay, good. Okay, so there's two theories that people put forward. The first theory is that uplift is still happening. We're still seeing uplift. It's just that we can't measure, or for whatever reason, geologists haven't been able to detect it. Perhaps it's a very gradual rate of uplift. And the second is that there was some sort of topographic rejuvenation in the Miocene. And we can get into all sorts of arguments and hand-waving about what caused this. But say simply that around 20 million years ago, there was some sort of dynamic topography or mantle upwelling that caused a spike of uplift to rejuvenate the topography in the Appalachian Mountains. So if we think about our E-star, R-star relationships, theory one suggests that we're still seeing uplift. So we should see the majority of our data points plotting above the steady state curve. We jump back. We would expect for theory one, we'd expect the majority of our data points to sit up here suggesting we're still seeing uplift in the range. However, if theory two is correct, and there was a spike of uplift 20 million years ago, and now we're seeing downwasting, then our E-star, R-star measurements would sit in this decaying area. They'd sit below the steady state curve. So we have our plot here, and if we throw the data on, again, we get this massive spread. Again, if we focus on the red area where the majority of the data is, and place this landscape average point, again, 85 to 95% of the data, roughly, is sitting considerably below the steady state curve. So we could take this as some tentative evidence that we're seeing topographic decay, suggesting there could have been this pulse of uplift at roughly 20 million years ago, rather than a constant uplift through time. So as I say, this is very tentative evidence. But it just demonstrates that just from analysing topography, we can get a lot of information about landscapes at a very wide range of scales. And again, some more shameless plugging before we finish. If you want to learn about this technique, grab the software to play around with this on your own data, or learn a bit more about this development of the Appalachian Mountains. My second paper came out in eSurf a few months after the first. And yeah, again, download it. Don't need to read it, just download. So I think I've talked for long enough, and I just want to kind of wrap up with some broad conclusions. The first is that topography has a lot of information about process. It's very easy to take a DEM and make a hillshade and then just maybe measure the gradient and leave it there and say, well, we've got a steep landscape here and a shallow landscape here. But realistically, there's a lot more information contained within topography if you know how to analyze it and how to pull that data out. So demonstrated in this talk that we've been able to falsify between two N-member sediment flux laws, and demonstrated for the Oregon Coast Range in particular, and for the Sierra Nevada, that we are seeing this strong non-linearity in sediment flux. We've also followed that up by applying a model that's predicated on non-linear flux, and again demonstrated that we are seeing this non-linearity. And I've also been able to show that we are able to fingerprint some kind of broad-scale idea of what's happening tectonically in a landscape. So in this case, in Kawita in the Southern Appalachian Mountains, we're possibly seeing this evidence of there being a rejuvenation and then decay of topography. But the only way that we can actually perform this kind of analysis is if we have reproducible methods to exploit this information. And that's where I can do some more advertising for the software package that we've been developing, LSD Topo Tools, to perform robust, repeatable, high-res topographic analysis. Truly, if we try and do a lot of these analyses using things like ArcMap or QGIS, we'll find that it's very painstaking, it's very inefficient, and it's never going to be the best way to actually get good, reproducible scientific results. But by writing open source code and then applying it to lots of landscapes, we can pull out a lot more information and build a lot on what people have done in the past. So I recommend people check this out if they're interested in analysing topography. And finally, the project you start isn't always the project you finish. I started off sitting in soil pits in the Appalachian Mountains eating barbecue and taking soil samples, and I finished off sitting in an office in London with four monitors writing code. Some people might say that I've got this wrong, but honestly, I couldn't have been happier with how this turned out. So I'll leave it there. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Stuart. I'm sure you'll be more than happy to answer any questions that anyone has. Well, we'll start with Dave.
Just going back to the Appalachians.
Yep.
And you posted two scenarios. One was soil uplift versus Miocene rejuvenation.
Yep.
And I suggest that there could be a third, which would be
a message on the story.
Well, I guess the thing, it suggests that topography is decaying. I guess you might have had topographic rejuvenation in the Miocene, but you could have had continuous uplift until sometime in the
geomorphologically recent. Yeah. So there's been a lot of work. I say this isn't really my direct field, but there's been a lot of work trying to calculate the volume of material that's been eroded by looking at retreating waterfalls and nick points across the landscape. So there's people are kind of beginning to fall down this kind of idea of rejuvenation in the Miocene based a lot on the volume of material that looks to have been eroded and looking at relict surfaces above and below nick points. So I think this is a gross oversimplification, but I think there's still some value in this in trying to demonstrate the usefulness of the dimensions framework for looking at uplift or decay. But I agree, there's almost certainly going to be some sort of middle ground. It's never black and white.
I guess when I follow that, this kind of subset of your report on the surface, you've created this kind of metrics of two-star and one-star, mm-hmm. but presumably for every pixel or every slope thing in your landscape. So have you plotted them on a map?
Yes.
And does it act, because some areas are uplifted, some areas are decaying. Does that you get a pattern that shows anything useful?
No, there's a lot of noise in the data, so you would struggle to see very, very clearly like a you know, a hot spot of uplift that you could, you know, throw your hat on. So I think if you were to get, so I haven't done this analysis in a really, really distinct landscape where we have two very clear regimes.
Right, because there could be lots of places where if you're looking at a tectonic control, you could go somewhere either side of a fault,
yeah,
and it would be very obvious, and you could go to places where maybe lots of these kind of blind thrusts in kind of tectonic hazard prone areas, kind of Iran, places like this, mm-hmm. would be, those show up.
Yeah. So yes, I think that's something that would be really interesting to do. The only limitation is we do need the high-res data, so I don't really know what the data availability is like in places like Iran. I mean, I think in... So I think it's one of these things that as we start to build up more data around active faulting areas, then we can look at it a bit more. During my master's, I looked at this technique along the San Andreas Fault and found some reasonably interesting patterns. But the problem is that a lot of the LiDAR that's collected for that, it's run, it's a very narrow strip collected along the trace of the fault. And we really need to be understanding the hill slopes a bit further out. So even when we do have LiDAR collected in some of these really interesting tectonic areas, we don't actually have enough of the data to say things conclusively. Question at the back?
Another question at the back, yes.
It's just a follow on from that. What do you reckon the sort of lowest resolution?
So if you read,
that wasn't a plan.
Yeah. So the third paper in my thesis is answering exactly that question, and the answer, shockingly, is that it depends. But basically, as a rule of thumb, if you can get data for doing this E star R star analysis, anything below 10 meter resolution, ideally around 5 meter resolution, you should begin to see these patterns. But you will have to accept that there's going to be more coarsening of the patterns. But yeah, so. I read my third paper. This is great advertising.
Yeah, so I guess that's something I never really thought about until I saw your diagram. But the steepness of the ridges seems to have a big impact on the hill slope plan. Because when you showed your picture, it looks like, you know, the water flows from the ridges, follows the ridge from a bit, and then goes down on the side of the hill slope. So if you've got ridges that are quite horizontal, then you may have the hill slope plan is going to go straight across the ridge. But if you've got steep relief with very steep ridges, it's going to go along the ridges before it goes into the channel. So how can that influence your results? Because, like, for example, like relief is not really, doesn't have any direction, so relief is just taken at the point. Whereas that hill slope plan seems to have quite an impact.
So you raise a good point, and one of the reasons why we have so few data points for places like Kawita and Gavilan Mesa is because we actually perform quite a lot of filtering to the data to make sure that the measurements that we have conform to our assumptions. So effectively, these models are all predicated on one-dimensional landscape evolution models. So we have to throw out certain types of trace that wouldn't conform to a broadly one-dimensional path. So in that case where we have a flow along a ridge line that then kind of turns and comes down, although they're in the visualization, they don't make it into this kind of analysis. So there is filtering of the data that has to take place in order for us to properly test these things.
No one else, then Dave again.
Okay, so in the plot where you measured, where you had the histogram to post like that, towards the start, so Gavilan Mesa and Oregon Coastal Range, which well-behaved landscapes, gave nice distributions of hill slopes around the median. With Kawita and the Sierra Nevada, you don't get quite such regular hill slope lengths. I'm wondering if you have any ideas what makes regular landscapes regular and irregular landscapes less regular.
That's a philosophical question. But, I think the reason that we see these kind of less normal distribution patterns in Kawita and the Sierra is because in Kawita and the Sierra there's plateaus that are then being incised into, and there's a lot more transients in the landscapes. So I think if we were to separate out the two different sections of the landscape, so in the Sierra, the low erosion rate, low relief plateau, and the steeper, more rapidly eroding canyons, we do see much more of a pair of normal distributions of hill lengths and reliefs for those kind of subsets of the landscape. But what I'm really trying to focus on in this work is to look at things at a very broad landscape scale and to try and see whether we can pick out fundamental patterns that kind of overcome these limitations of transients within landscapes.
Okay, well, I'd like to thank Stuart yet again for an excellent panel talk, and yeah, I'm sure he can answer any more questions you have in person. But yeah, okay. Thank you very much.